Good Vibrations.
Welcome back to Good Vibrations, and we are here on the auspicious occasion of the 35th anniversary of the so-called Second Summer of Love. This was a phrase that was used by the mainstream media of the time, and it actually referred to two summers, 1988 and 89. This was the birth of the UK acid house rave scene, which paved the way for the explosion in worldwide electronic dance music and clubbing culture. So it had a lot to answer for. Myself and my guests were actually around in 1988, embroiled in that whole scene. So we've all got experiences and stories to share. And I love the fact that we're recording this on the summer solstice of 2023. So it's 21st of June, the longest day. You couldn't get a more relevant day to be discussing a summer of love. And today is also the birthday of Tim Simonon, who's better known as Bomb the Bass. And I love the fact that he was one of the instrumental figures in that early dance music scene in the UK. Bomb the Bass had their big hit Beat Diss. The sleeve design to it featured that infamous smiley yellow face, which came to be adopted as an icon of the acid house scene. This one had a blood splatter on it. We'll get on to that. So I just want to bring my guests in who, like me, have done a ton of research into subjects all about social engineering and mass mind control, all that good stuff. And the questions we're going to be asking today in the first of what is probably going to be about a 98-part series, judging by the volume of information we've got, is how authentic and grassroots that scene really was versus it being yet another social engineering psyop. So joining me today, I've got the boys from Sheep Farm Studios who know all about this stuff. Welcome first to Dom.
Hi, Mark. Good to be here, as usual.
Good to have you, brother. And also, Chris, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting us on.
All right. And also joining us shortly is going to be Matt Sergiu. I've probably knackered his last name there as well. Of the Occult Beatles and Conspiro Media sites. And he's also my co-host on the Magical Mystery Talk series, where we get into the Beatles. And I'll be very surprised if the Beatles don't figure in today's conversation somewhere. So we'll bring Matt in soon, but just to get things started, what were we all doing in 1988, guys? I mean, myself, I wasn't yet a DJ. I started DJing in 1990. So in 88, I was going out clubbing. I didn't actually go to any of these open air raves. It was just like indoor clubs with me. There was one in Oxford, Boodles, on a Monday night. Night called Lust. I went to the Wag Club in London a few times, but really I was just out raving. I didn't pop any pills back in the day because I didn't like the idea of losing control. A lot of people find it very hard to believe that I never did the pills, but that's what I was doing in 88, just partying, enjoying the music and watching with great interest. So how about you guys?
You're into that, Chris?
Well, to be fair, I was still at school, so I didn't I got more the aftermath of the 88, 89, but I was well aware of it. Like 89, I first started probably going out to bars and nightclubs and stuff. But it was in the night, probably 90, when I really started going proper clubbing. But I was very aware of it and almost jealous because I remember seeing all the the open air clubs and stuff going on, and I wanted to be part of it because I was like 15, just ready to leave school.
You certainly made up for it.
And I'm not ashamed to say I did go out in the 90s and I did pop the pills and do the nasty, if you like. But I had a great time. I thought it was great fun. Not really aware of what was going on. But one thing I was thinking about before we did this was, when you talk about taking the pills, if you like, the music got so entranced in your head that if you heard a tune on a normal weekday, you'd get palpitations. Just on a very basic level. I remember that because I remember talking to my friends about it.
You'd come up again, so to speak. Yeah.
But on a weekday, you know, because we were weak. I wasn't as into it as my friends. Some of my friends were massively into it. They'd organise trips and buses and I'd kind of tag along. I wasn't really into the DJs like they were. I'd still go home and listen to soul music, if I'm honest. But I did love going out and listening. When it first started, the movement, when it went into the 90s, and it was all happy house, a lot of piano based, lyrical based music. I loved that stuff. That was what I liked. When it went really trancey, I weren't as keen, but I still dragged along though. But my mates were well into it. A lot of my mates became DJs as well. And yeah, they were more on it than me, but I went along and I did enjoy it, I have to say.
Didn't you used to go clubbing with Mark Bajerski?
Dom did.
I did, yeah.
wasn't he a dancer back in the day?
He was a raver. That was it. He was a professional dancer with Mark. Yeah. In the 90s, I sort of met Mark in 93-ish and we started going out clubbing. But back into 88, 89, I was, 18, 19 then. And I'd just started going out into the town, out into the local nightclub, Sunsets.
Imagine that, Mark, in Huddersfield in the 80s and 90s. There was a nightclub called Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Queuing up in the rain.
Yeah, the way the sun sets over the corrugated iron roofs of the warehouses on the industrial estate is beautiful.
Yeah, where the sun sets through the dark clouds and the pissing down rain. Yeah.
But the northern dancing was massive, even compared to it came from the north, didn't it? It was a massive movement. I remember going to the first clubs down south and realizing how different they were. It was a lot different to the ones that were.
I tell you what I noticed, the shift in music, because it happened quite quickly, because I just started going out and it was all Rick Astley and all that type of music. And all of a sudden it changed. Inner City came out and what have you, and it changed to electronic dance music. And I loved Inner City. I loved their style of music. I actually thought they were from England for a long time, but they're not. They're an American band, aren't they? And a lot of the house stuff, that Voodoo Ray and all this other stuff that started coming out. And I loved it. And but you could, there was a change. And then people who were coming into the clubs who I knew were saying, have you been here? Have you tried ecstasy? I'm like, what's ecstasy? It's a drug. And I didn't drink at that particular point. I didn't drink, didn't do anything. I'd never been a drinker. So going back to what you say, I never liked to be out of control. I was trained and looked after myself. And I never wanted to drink. I never wanted to do any of this stuff. Anyway, I ended up getting into the other stuff. Probably after Chris, actually. So I was going clubbing, like you, Mark, for quite a number of years without actually partaking in the extracurriculum. I didn't even drink, Chris. I drove.
Well, we had a lot of natural energy back in those days because we were young. We could handle it. I remember going out clubbing till 2-3 o'clock in the morning and then being at work at 7 and being just fine.
Trying to do that now.
I had a yellow Sherpa van and I put a settee in the back and everyone just got in my yellow Sherpa van and we went out to a club. And so I drove. there were about 10 of us in this van.
Yeah, you were the designated non-drinking driver.
Yeah.
Most of the time, wasn't it?
Yes. So the early days of clubbing, there was a quite defined change of music, which, as we know, we're probably going to get into, that doesn't just happen. So you had all this Stock Aitken and Waterman style music, plastic dance music.
There's a bit of an underground soul music scene.
There's an underground soul. That's where I used to go out, the soul stuff. And then that changed. It changed to faster beats, which I liked as well.
But you can pinpoint it, like you're saying, to 88, 89, because I was still at school in 89. And that, when it went into the mainstream, that song Acid came out. Did you remember? Yeah. With that psychedelic music video. And I remember it being, thinking, what the heck is that? You know, what is this stuff? But then seeing it on the news and the outside parties and thinking, I want to be part of that. That looks bad.
Did you ever go to the Hacienda?
Yeah.
I used to go there every Saturday.
But again, me and Dom kind of crossed over because I was a bit more hedonistic than Dom, let's say, at a younger age. And I started going out. And then we kind of met in the middle, didn't we? And then we both started. We used to go out sometimes together. But I was down in London then, I think. So you were going out with your mate. Because I was surprised you came and saw me and you said, you've been to Hacienda. And I'm thinking, what? You've been to Hacienda?
Yeah.
And he was going every week.
I mean, the Hacienda, it was like the Mecca of the North for dance music at that particular point.
Well, that raises another question in itself. Why that venue, that crowd?
Well, again, why? I mean, I have looked into those people, and you have to ask all these organic things popping up, and I'm sure some of them are organic, but then they turn out to be something totally different. And a lot of these things always do. Why? So Manchester had one. I think Birmingham had one, the Cool Club in Birmingham.
Leeds had one.
Yeah, every city or large town had a major club that was putting out this electronic dance music, and they're all hiring the same DJs and acts and pushing the same culture and drugs. In every major city, you could pinpoint a big club brand.
If you think of it as an operation, Mark, you've got to look. So you've got the record labels. Then behind that, you've got the politics that are willing to sign a dance band who are promoting a drug culture that's apparently illegal. And so you've got massive corporations setting up independent labels so they can hide behind these independent labels that are then pushing drug culture in every town.
It's like a corporate network across the UK.
Yeah.
And then you've got clubs like the Hacienda, for instance, Fire, which have got security, which has never been seen before, taking drugs off people and turning them away. But then there's still tons of drugs in the clubs. So somebody's letting certain dealers get in there. And
all drugs are equal, but some drugs are more equal than others, to paraphrase Orwell.
You can sell yours, but you can't sell yours.
Yeah. But I mean, you're always going to create that pressure cooker, because obviously people then get in on the act, etc. But from a top level down, they don't care about that. They're just little ripples that are floating around. But at top level, that's some planning that they knew that at exactly that time there was going to be an explosion in electronic dance music. And, you know,
and it happened in a year.
And it happened in a year. Just a bit like the hippie movement in the 60s. That happened, sort of like happened overnight, or it seemed, that's how it was portrayed. It just happened.
And I remember, because I moved to London in the 1990, I think it was. And I remember going to, from like northern clubs, like I've been to ASEAN or whatever, and then going to Ministry of Sound and just thinking, this is a different kettle of fish. This is corporate. It's proper corporate. I mean, you could say Hacienda was, but that was a brand.
I think there might be a clue in the name there. Ministry, like government department.
Yeah. The logo is literally, it looks like...
It's like a portcullis, isn't it?
The Windsor logo, doesn't it? It looks like there.
But also, even going back to the late 90s, the millennium changed dance music again, where they'd split it up into so many different genres. This happy hardcore nonsense and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, everything was just like hip hop mixed into one. There is no defining sound anymore to these.
I remember it going from happy house music to literally techno coming out. And a few of my friends got into that and going to a club and thinking, my word, this is just bizarre. Everyone's moving so fast. But that was another change. That was another branch off of when it started as house music, wasn't it?
Well, I definitely want to get into some of the parallels between the 80s scene and that 60s counterculture scene that preceded it, because there are so many connections and so many overlaps and so many similarities there. So I want to draw on quite a few of those. But I just want to preface this by saying that I'm very surprised that we seem to be the first researchers in 35 years to be asking these sort of questions about how authentic that scene was. When you think about how many people got caught up in it, the many millions of young people just like us that were in the crosshairs of those that devised this scene, it is amazing that these questions haven't been more widely asked.
I think it comes back to what we were talking about in one of the other podcasts, Mark, where people have this emotional attachment to this stuff. Means that we were all in it. I had a good time, you know. I can't deny I had a good time. But that doesn't stop me from looking at it under a microscope.
I mean, the interesting thing about that 60s counterculture is what you're seeing is that the people that have generally picked it apart are the next generation on. So it's not the baby boomers that were caught up in it that are asking the questions. It's our generation, Generation X. So we're looking to a time before we were around and putting it under the microscope. But there's very few of our generation looking at the scene that we were a part of ourselves. Maybe that's going to come in 20, 25 years' time from now. A new generation of researchers would look back to the late 80s, you know, and pick it apart like we are the 60s. But there's very few of our generation that are prepared to look at that, it seems, and ask questions about how genuine it was because of that emotional attachment. Like you said, nostalgia. It means so much of us to be a part of that thing, and it's very painful and very uncomfortable to even question how authentic it might have been.
Tough pill to swallow. Pardon the pun.
Yeah,
that's fine.
but it is because again, as we know, with what we've lived through the last 3 years, questioning anything in your life just unravels everything. But we've already gone through that process, so nothing really worries us three and people.
I do remember at the time having a very late night discussion with someone, and you know, with the stuff that was going around, and saying, "But what's this stuff going to do to it? I'm not even thinking about the music. What's this stuff going to do to us in 10 years? We don't know."
Mm.
I remember that as well, yeah. Just thinking there's an entire generation that's going out every weekend and popping these pills, and nobody knows what the long-term effect is going to be in 20, 25 years' time. We know another agenda like that recently, don't we? Where we've been hearing what the long-term effects might be. But I know many people, many of my friends, like you were saying, Chris, would go out at the weekend, they'd get high, they'd come down by about Monday morning, ready for work, and by sort of Wednesday, Thursday, they're planning the next weekend again. It all begins on Friday night, and they literally live for the weekend. You know, they slog it through the week just so they can go and relive that experience again at the weekend.
I was a student, so I didn't have quite as much disposable income as some of my friends, so I was in and out a little bit more than some of my mates, but a lot of my mates were every weekend. That was it. And there was a few. There's a few people I think who I've met who I've known through the years, and I think it had a detrimental effect on them. I think, you know, there's a few who got questionably ill, or ill then better, and I think it was definitely to do with that, to be honest with you.
Also, if you think about it, that taking a pill, a lot of my friends who were bodybuilders took steroids as well. So you could equate as a similar movement, although it's nothing to do with music, it was something to do with taking drugs and enhancing something.
So you've got the hedonists and the fitness people.
Exactly, yes. So the fitness world, a lot of them are into illegal drugs as well. And that could be a programming element to get you into the pharmaceutical world of legal drugs, that they make a difference to your life, a beneficial difference to your life as well. So there could be another element. Let's flood them with these illegal drugs. They get this high. Then when we tell them to take a prescription drug, they're going to take that anyway because it works.
It's legal.
And it's legal. But yeah.
Right. I just want to give a shout out to Greg, who's going to be editing this video. He's going to be splicing in many of the images that we're going to be talking about, maybe a bit of footage, and just bringing this whole thing to life. So big thanks to Greg for that. All right, it's time to bring in Matt Serju, my co-host on Magical Mystery Talk of the Occult Beatles and Conspiro Media Sites. He's joining us now. So Matt, let's start off by asking you what you were doing in 1988.
Wow. Well, I was, up until about 10 years ago, a professional DJ. So when I left school when I was 16, I have to say I was very fortunate I've always wanted to be a DJ. Well, pretty much from when I was about 11 years old, I got into music when I was much younger than that. But I kind of decided from when I was about 10, 11, I wanted to be a DJ. Radio, clubs, it didn't really matter. And I just count myself as one of those lucky people that, it's the arrogance of youth, isn't it? When you're young, you don't think, oh, I should really go to college. I should go to university and really set myself up with something just in case this DJing lark doesn't work out and I end up not having a job and all the rest of it. But yeah, the arrogance of youth. I thought, no, I'll be fine. I'm going to leave school. I'm going to become a DJ. And yeah, that's what happened. I worked at it and left school, and I was a professional DJ from about 16, 17 years of age, up until about 10 years ago. So about 28, 29 years as a professional DJ. I still do a bit of radio DJing. When 1988 came along, I was at the ripe age, you might say. I was 18, 19 years old. I was a DJ that could play anything.
What, weddings, bar mitzvahs?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, End at Night.
Funeral wakes.
Not quite as bad as that, but I was an all-rounder. Yeah, so, and I appreciated all kinds of music. So there was a lot of stuff coming out back then, wasn't there, in 88? It wasn't just the acid house stuff. There was a Rare Groove. I don't know if you guys mentioned any of this. Rare Groove, there was the hip-hop.
Stock Aitken Waterman, all that stuff was around.
Yeah, okay, we'll brush aside that.
Well, Mike Stock is awake now, you know. He's paying attention and speaking out and saying stuff that needs to be said.
This is totally off the scale. So I'm
not keeping quiet anymore, and I don't really care what avenues I go down. It's got to be exposed from the very beginning. It's the same elements at work, and a lot of the time the same people, the hidden people at the top at work. So that's what's brought me here now. Somebody's got to do something. I mean, I'm fed up with talking, but there's this element and this sub-level which needs to be exposed.
There was that Roadblock song they released. When it was released, they tried to pass it off as a 70s song so that it would get played in the sort of the underground nightclubs by the, you know, the cool people, you know, and they fooled a lot of people. A lot of people who heard it thought it was a 70s soul track, but it was actually Stock Aitken and Waterman. So, you know, that was there was a lot of genres around at that time, as well as acid house. There was hip hop, which was doing really well at that time, sort of 1980s. It was leading up to its golden age in sort of 1989, 1990, 91. What else was there? There was like a lot of soul, R&B, swing beat. There was just so much good club stuff.
Alexandra O'Neill, Janet Jackson, all that Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, M2ME, yeah. Zapp, Frankie Beverly and Maze. You could just
now you're
go
talking.
On.
Now you're talking my language, Mark.
just so much good stuff. And I appreciated all of it. And I play all of this stuff when I was a DJ. I play the pop stuff, but I play a lot of the club stuff as well. And yeah, Acid House, I played that as well because, as I say, I was ripe for it. I was ripe for it, but I wasn't a specialist DJ. I didn't specialize in acid house.
Well, that's the interesting thing about DJs in those times where, you know, they weren't all-rounders. They would play a bit of hip-hop, a bit of acid house, a bit of soul, all on the same night. The specialist DJs hadn't really splintered off into their different scenes at that point. I think this is a good point to really get this discussion going, actually staying with the idea of DJs, because we've got to start somewhere with this, and why not with what I'm referring to as the Cinderella fairy story as to how the whole acid house rave scene took place. What we constantly get told is that the whole thing started as a result of four young lads who were DJs in London who went on holiday to Ibiza in August of 1987 to celebrate Paul Oakenfold's birthday. So we're talking Paul Oakenfold, who's gone on to become a hugely successful dance music DJ and producer, a household name, scoring Hollywood movies these days. Danny Rampling, who I count as a friend these days. I've got to know Danny very well. Danny is that rarest of entities. He's a well-known DJ who's not been afraid to stand up and say what's needed to be said over the past 2 or 3 years. But Danny was a part of that whole scene, and he was one of those DJs who sort of instigated the entire acid house genre. Then you've got Nicky Holloway, who was a promoter and DJ in London, and Johnny Walker, not the Radio 2 Johnny Walker, but a different one. They completed the four. And we're told they went to Ibiza, tried ecstasy for the first time. They were dancing open air under the stars to sounds spun by DJ Alfredo, Balearic Beats. They came back to London and they'd had such an epiphany through this experience that they wanted to try and recreate it for the British crowd. So they started club nights like Shum from Danny Rampling, The Project, Future, Spectrum from Paul Oakenfold, The Theatre of Madness from Nicky Holloway, and that's how the whole thing got started. That, to me, sounds like a very simplistic explanation and a bit of a cover story. Call me suspicious, but, you know, I've seen a thing or two before of this nature. It reminds me of the story we get about the Beatles. You know, it's just four young lads from Liverpool, working class, wrote a few catchy songs, punted around some demo tapes, Brian Epstein comes across it and signs them, and all this. It reminds me of what we're told about the Arctic Monkeys, how they got famous. Apparently they posted their songs on MySpace, and millions of people found them and went, "Damn, this band is good," and that's how they became famous. It strikes me as a bit of a cover story, so let's use that as a starting point. Matt, what do you make of that story? Are you buying it?
Well, I have to say from this point that I've been invited along to this discussion. Basically, as you know, Mark, and you guys know that I'm going to be giving you, or hoping to be giving you, a perspective of what I've been researching with regards to social engineering, and my speciality for the last 7 or so years has been predominantly on the 60s counterculture movement, the UK counterculture movement, London, which is where a lot of it was going on and where a lot of what happened during the sort of the building up of the underground movement later spread out into the rest of the UK. So that's why I'm here, kind of, to give you a because there are parallels between the 60s and the so-called second summer of love.
Loads of parallels.
Loads of parallels. And so I don't have as much, I haven't really looked into, I was there at the time in the 80s DJing and I was on the peripheries of it as well. I got involved in a couple of like house parties myself. I organized a couple myself. I know of DJs. There's one DJ who comes from the same town as me, who went to the same school as me. We actually set up a pirate dance station back in 1991 to 93, and he went on to support the Prodigy and also Enjoy. Anyone remember Enjoy?
Yeah, Anthem.
The Anthem, and yeah. Although I was involved with it, I sort of dipped my toe in the water at the time. In terms of research, as I say, I've been predominantly in the last few years looking at the 60s. So I haven't got a lot of information about what was going on in the 80s in terms of, you know, an alternative outlook, if you like. But what I want to ask you is, some of the DJs that went along to Ibiza to this quote unquote Cinderella story and took part in this Cinderella story, how many of those DJs actually started out as soul DJs and then forsook their soul roots and became dance DJs and never went back to their soul roots? How many of them?
Oh, there's many. I emailed you a list of them the other day, just off the top of my head. There's Pete Tong, Danny Rampling, Judge Jules, Carl Cox, Paul Oakenfold, Graham Gold, Dave Pierce, probably many others. But those guys all started out playing soul and funk and black music of the day. And then when acid house and dance music came along, they all jumped on that bandwagon. And as you say, they've never looked back. And it strikes me that there was a sort of infrastructure in place there. And if we're going down the route of suggesting that this whole acid house scene was a social engineering psyop, and I'll lay my cards on the table and say that's what I feel it was, then they would have been looking for an existing infrastructure that could have been used as a vehicle for getting this new music and this new culture out there. And so it's my contention that they took these existing soul and funk DJs who already had a bit of a history and a heritage and a following, and they used them to push these new styles onto their crowds to sort of lead them Pied Piper-like into this new scene. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, okay, well, to give you a 60s parallel between what you've just said, to compare the 80s and the Ibiza, the fairy tale story, if you like, in the 60s, and then I'll drop out of this and let you, the rest of you guys, discuss this. I have noticed that there were parallels with the 60s, because if you look at the 1960s, what happened when the psychedelic music started to go mainstream, sort of 66, 67 into 68, and then in 69, it kind of tapered off, went into heavy rock. Well, look at the bands that took it up. The Beatles, when they started out, they were R&B. They played a lot of show tunes as well. When they were at the Cavern in Hamburg, they played a lot of old show standards from the musicals. They had quite an eclectic mix of their set list was very eclectic. But basically, when they hit it big, they were covering a lot of Motown songs and a lot of soul tracks. The Rolling Stones, again, ditto, blues, R&B, rock and roll, you know, Chuck Berry and all that kind of stuff. And then when the acid thing kicked off in 66, 67, they completely went into it. The Stones did dip out of it very quickly afterwards. But both of them, you know, in 67, they released Satanic Majesty's Request album, The Stones, which was the Stones really going psychedelic. And the Beatles as well, Sgt. Pepper, also Magical Mystery Tour following that album, also the tracks off Revolver. And they completely pushed aside their R&B roots, the Beatles did. The Stones, sure, they did go back to their blues roots. They only kind of dipped their toes in the water with the Satanic Majesty's album in December 67. But the Beatles never really went back to their R&B. They did do the Get Back, Let It Be sessions in 69, 70, which were kind of R&B-ish, you could say. But yeah, I mean, and you've got other bands like the Moody Blues. When they were around in sort of 64, 65, they were kind of R&B-ish. And they went fully psychedelic after 67, and they never went back.
And then you got Pink Floyd, who sort of did it in reverse, because when they first emerged, they were very psychedelic, and then they went off down that progressive rock route. And Status Quo is another one. When they first emerged with Pictures of Matchstick Men and all this, they were very psychedelic and trippy, and then they went sort of R&B and blues. So those two did it in reverse.
And Deep Purple as well. They started off quite psychedelic-ish. And went heavy rock very soon. You know, their first album, I think, was more kind of psychedelic-ish, but they didn't stick with that either. But look, bands like the Moody Blues, they picked up on the psychedelic thing and never went back. They went fully prog. So you do kind of have like parallels there with the 60s as well. I can't think off the top of my head of any other bands. There's also Steve Winwood. When he first started, he was all blues and jazz, and he went with Traffic and went kind of psychedelic too. Eric Burdon, who was in the Animals, they were R&B and blues, and Eric Burdon later went to San Francisco and took acid, and he went kind of psychedelic too. So you do have kind of a parallel there, but not to the same extent with the guys who went to Ibiza, because they completely, whereas as opposed to the 60s, where some of these bands I've mentioned did kind of dip back into their R&B roots again, some of them did. The Ibiza DJs didn't. That was it. Once they came back from Ibiza, they never really played soul music in public again, did they?
So you had an infrastructure with bands in the 60s, and in the 80s it was DJs that were being used to push this. So it's just a reflection of the changing times there.
Yeah, back in the day, back the undergrounds, the 60s so-called underground, because they don't call it counterculture. I've been told by people who were around back in the 60s, they've sent me emails and say, hey, man, they say to me, you know, we didn't call it counterculture back then. We called it underground. It was the underground. There were underground DJs in London who championed that kind of psychedelic scene, if you like. And one of those was John Peel. Another one was Jeff Dexter, if I'm not mistaken. And Jeff Dexter, if I'm not mistaken, I might be wrong about this, but I think when he first started out, he was mod. He was into the mod thing and soul but I might be wrong about that. But I seem to recall having read that he's another one that started off as a soul boy and kind of went into the psychedelic thing. But yeah, you've also got John Peel as well, and who championed it.
Well, we've got some parallels going already there between these two scenes. And there's going to be plenty more of that.
There were a couple of events that took place in the 60s, like underground events in London. And I can recall at least one. You can find a poster of it online, and it was called a rave. And a lot of these parties that took place back then, these psychedelic parties with all these bands that used to play, like Pink Floyd, Soft Machine. There's a band called The Deviants. The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, the guy that did the hit single Fire. They used to play at these underground events in London, and there was, yeah, it was strobe lights, bouncy inflatables, you know, that kind of thing. So again, you can see a parallel there too.
Weren't there some venues that crop up in both scenes as well in the 60s and the 80s? I think you said the Africa Centre in Covent Garden, which was famous for Soul to Soul, holding some of their raves there in the 80s.
Yeah, I've lost my research on that, but I do recall us some years back, Mark, sharing some info about that. I seem to recall that Yoko Ono did some events there back in the day, back in the late 60s sometime, yeah.
Bloody hell, it's even venues that are compromised now, not just individuals.
Yeah, so there's plenty more parallels.
I'll just throw a few more in, and then I'll go to Dom and Chris on this, as there were a few notes from my Musical Truth Volume 2 book, where I've got two chapters on all this stuff. So there's the song by Danny Wilson, which came out in 1989, called The Second Summer of Love, where in the lyrics, they're drawing parallels between the 60s and the 80s. And the lyrics include, the second summer of love is here, so tell your angry friends to throw away their goatee and grow their hair again. Then you've got Paul Oakenfold through his Jibaro single that he put out, one of these Balearic Beats tunes, and also his Future Club Night, using a one-eye symbol, like a bloodshot single eye, which had previously been used by the Grateful Dead in the 60s and that LSD era. You got D-Mob in their famous song, We Call It Acid, where they say, you turn on, you tune in, you drop out, acid has that effect. That seems to be a direct homage being paid to Timothy Leary and him pushing LSD. There was a club night I've got a flyer for, a night that was called Listen, See, Destroy, LSD, with the divine styler, that Timothy Leary of hip-hop. There's promotion for Spectrum's first all-day event. I think that would have been Paul Oakenfold. And on the flyer, it says, can you pass the acid test? Which is a throwback to Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters, CIA assets who used to distribute free LSD to the attendees of hippie communities and psychedelic festivals in California. There was a song by the Easy Posse, Everything Starts With an E, subtle title, talking about tripping out to Hendrix solos, Excuse Me While I Kiss the Sky. There was a track simply titled E by an artist of the same name, which contains vocal samples of the phrase LSD, as well as dialogue lifted from The Prisoner, the 1960s trippy TV series, which is very psychedelic itself. So I'll just leave it there. There's plenty of other, you know, connections between the 60s and the 80s, but I'll go to Dom now, because I know you've got a bit of a suspicious mind, I think it's fair to say, similar to myself. So what sort of suspicions are getting raised for you as we discuss these parallels between these two scenes?
I was because you guys had a DJing brain, I've got a business brain. So I would look at the corporations behind it. That's one place I generally start. And so a lot of these things lead back to places like Columbia Records and things like that, Polydor, like the Beatles were signed to and what have you. And the people that started these things, you've got, or the investors, should I say, JP Morgan was an investor in Columbia Records. So the Morgans were involved, who was a Rothschild. So you've got people like that behind these large record organisations. I think we've worked out that, I think it was it Sony, Chris, that they were the ones that were part of AT&T, they were linked to AT&T, the telecoms company, and they came with, they utilised the emoji. So the emoji and the smiley face go hand in hand as well. So the corporations are key. So whoever's behind the business push are coming up with a plan to push this music. It can't happen by chance. It just doesn't work that way. Nothing in business happens, but these corporations have, as we know with the family type links, they have 50, 100 year plans. They know what's coming well in advance of four guys who just happen to be in Ibiza and end up getting out of the mind, coming up with some electronic dance music. It can't work like that.
I've looked into this quite extensively. A few years back, there's an article on my site, Conspiro Media, where I look at some labels that have very real links to the military, one of which is Decca Records, which doesn't really exist anymore. And when I say it doesn't really exist anymore, I mean it doesn't exist in the way that it did, let's say, back in the 40s, 50s and 60s, when it was a huge label, especially in the 60s. One of the bands that it signed was the Rolling Stones. The Stones were on Decca that was the first label they signed to, and they stayed with them till about 69, 70 and then left. And there's a statement that Keith Richards made at around the time that they were leaving the label. And he said, we don't want to be on this label because we're giving money to fund Decca Records to bomb in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by this. So I started looking into Decca Records history. And then that set me off onto, yeah, this wider, as it always does when you do these things, it sets you off into this, like, you know, almost infinite kind of journey of discovery.
Yeah, well, we all know that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and with regards to the Decca, I don't have my notes here in front of me, so I'm trying to take this by memory. I don't have the article in front of me either. I was going to say that Decca's... No, go for it, and I'll...
Well, if you think about EMI was a JP Morgan construct. So they were the funders that merged a load of companies together that ended up being EMI. That then went on to sign the Beatles through Polydor, which was a label that they owned.
Yeah.
So they've got a smaller label like Polydor that nobody links to EMI or would link if they were buying the Beatles records. And it's a similar process to what dance music was. They had all these smaller labels that were linked to bigger labels behind the scenes because they can't just set a little label up. Yeah, they can have their own publishing and things like that. But behind the scenes, they've got a bigger label behind them. And And so the corporate structure is important, is what I'm trying to say. Also, yeah. The '60s with the gurus, me and Chris, well, I did some research and found out that all the gurus that were being used in the '60s, Maharishi, whatever, there were several of them anyway, let's just say. Some of them now have got massive NGOs. One of them had an NGO that were worth $5 billion that was all part of the trans and meditation drive all through the '60s. And one of the gurus of the Beatles, the guru Manesh.
Maharishi.
Maharishi Manesh. Yeah, that's him. He was also, I've got pictures of him with Yuri Bezmenov in the '60s while Bezmenov was in the KGB. And so all of a sudden you've got the KGB infiltrating the yogis. And also the yogis came from prominent Indian families that were pushed through the Indian civil service that went through Oxford, Cambridge, London School of Economics, and then went back to India and grew the beards and became gurus for all these pop bands.
Yeah. Well, the thing with Decca is it had, and I say had because, as I say, it's not really, it's still around as a label, but it's not as big as it was. It had military connections. It dealt with radar. It began to, in the 1940s, it developed radar during the Second World War for, I think, the UK and both the US, but I'm not exactly sure. And then right after the war, it decided to really invest in radar and make it an arm of its company. So as well as releasing music, it was also developing and manufacturing radar. And one of the products, if you like to use that word, products that it was manufacturing, as Keith Richard says, was a product, if you like, an invention, a gadget, a device that was being used in Vietnam to bomb the Vietnamese. And it was a radar system that was attached to helicopters, I think it was. And Decca not only manufactured and produced these and delivered them to the US troops in Vietnam, but they also supplied the US troops with Decca staff, Decca radar staff, in order to train the pilots on the helicopters how to use the radar.
It's amazing, isn't it, Matt, that some of these labels like EMI worked with Marconi then developed the frequencies that they put into TVs and telecommunication systems. So a lot of these military weapons were then utilized in the mass media that we use today, TV screens, radio, whatever.
Indeed, EMI, again, military background. In the war, it provided radar for the war effort for the UK. As I say, I don't have my notes here in front of me. I'm doing this off memory, so I'm going to be very basic with it. But after the war, it continued to develop radar. And I think it was sometime in the late 1970s, EMI was bought by another company. It became Thorn EMI. And then it went into nuclear defence. And it became, I think, Britain's largest defence contractor. Well,
Cliff Richard's dad worked for Thorn EMI.
Well, there you go. And that was the label that the Beatles were on. So you got Decca on one side. You had this rivalry, didn't you, in the '60s that was created. And we now know that it was created because the instigators of it back then, the actual people that were part of it, now tell us that it was orchestrated. There was an orchestrated PR drive in the '60s to have the Rolling Stones on one side pitted against the cute, cuddly Beatles. So it was the cute, cuddly mop tops in the early to mid '60s on one side that were crowd pleasers and audience pleasers for the cross-generational audience, and then on the other side you have the scruffy, uncouth Rolling Stone. So a dialectic by any other name, and you have it with the labels. On one side you've got Decca, military defense. On the other side you've got EMI, military defense. And also with regards to Sony, I think it's now owned by UMG, which is Universal Music Group.
That's right.
Okay, Universal Music Group is, as we speak, or the last time I looked about a year ago, again, this is in my article on Conspiramedia, which is under, it's actually part of a Rothschild's article. And it's part two, it's a two-part article series. And the family that owns UMG owns Vivendi, right? And it's Vivendi that now owns UMG, the United Music Group. And it is the largest company in the world, if I'm not mistaken. It owns EMI, it's got Decca, it owns Abbey Road Studios. I think it also owns Motown and Def Jam. countless Island Records, I think. I might be wrong, but it's got this umbrella. It's an umbrella in it. And underneath that umbrella is just all these labels and Abbey Road Studios as well. Now, the family that owns it, it's owned by Vivendi. The family that owns Vivendi are a French family by the name of Bolloré. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's spelled B-O-L-L-O-R-E. Okay, I might be pronouncing it wrong. The guy that the head of the family is Vincent Bolloré. And in more recent years, I think he's passed it over to his two sons, whose names escape me.
He's actually propped up in my research of this family, Matt. They own a fact checking company as well.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, that's handy.
Very handy. Yeah.
Well, I looked into his Vincent's bloodline and discovered that on his mother's side, he's related to the Rothschilds. Hmm. So by hook or by crook, in one way, shape, or form or another, we have the Rothschilds. The Rothschild bloodline effectively owning the largest music group.
Trip into that to add something to you. I've done some research on the Schwab bloodline that goes all the way back to Frankfurt and to a rabbi such and such in the mid 1500s, I think. And all these bloodlines go back to that one area within that. And that includes the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, etc., etc.
You know, you just can't have a conversation like this without Rothschilds, Rockefellers and Huxleys cropping up, right?
Well, let me jump into the Huxley one. Matt was explaining that. There's a guy who worked with Marconi, who was a radar specialist, and he was called Peter Pendleton Eckersley. He was a pioneer of the BBC. He was one of the founders of the BBC. And he is the son of Rachel Huxley, who was the daughter of Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, eugenicist, who was a direct cousin of Aldous and Sir Julian and Sir Andrew Andrew Huxley. So the founders of the BBC were one of the Huxleys, is that what I'm trying to say.
Doesn't surprise me. I've just thought of another parallel between the 60s and the 80s when you were talking about the Rolling Stones there, Matt, which is that Mick Jagger studied at the London School of Economics, which is like a social engineering think tank connected, no doubt, to Tavistock. Then he went on to lead the Rolling Stones, who were involved briefly in that psychedelic movement. And then a generation later, also coming out of the LSE, you've got Judge Jules, who graduated with a law degree, but then went on to become a DJ and promoter pushing acid house and ecstasy culture. And he's since gone back to a career as a lawyer, as well as being a DJ. But there's the LSE figuring in both scenes.
Yeah. LSE, when the Pink Floyd first started, and they were like, they were basically when the UK counterculture... I'm using the word counterculture, the UK underground, okay, which was basically this is before the hippie and the psychedelic thing went mainstream and was, you know, and millions became, you know, got to know about it and got involved in it, when it was still the underground scene in London and before Pink Floyd shot to fame, Syd Barrett era, basically, they were the darlings of the underground movement. They were the de facto house band. I think I might have mentioned this in passing before to you guys, along with Soft Machine as well, which was another band, but it was predominantly Pink Floyd who were the darlings of that scene. They had two managers who managed them at the same time. One of their managers was a guy by the name of Peter Jenner. Before he managed Pink Floyd, directly before he managed Pink Floyd, he was a lecturer at the London School of Economics. And so the story goes, this is what he said. I heard an interview with him some years back. This is how glib he was about it. he says, yeah, I just, you know, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, of course. He said, yeah, of course, I was, you know, I was a lecturer at the LSE. But, you know, I really fancied getting into music management. So, and one day I just went down to this club. I popped down into this club and I saw Syd Barrett and I saw Pink Floyd. And I thought, hey, they're the guys for me. I'm going to manage them. So I left my job as a lecturer at the LSE and became their manager.
Like you do.
Like you do. Exactly. As you do. That's what you do, isn't it? Yeah.
Yep. From LSE to LSD. Yeah, and also Tim Westwood, the son of an Anglican bishop who attended public school in Norwich, an extremely exclusive public school, went on to play hip-hop in grimy underground clubs in London, you know, like you do. That sounds very convincing. That sounds plausible. All these stories that we get. Chris, have you got anything to add there to anything we just said?
Well, one thing that struck me, Matt, was, you know, when you said those guys went to Ibiza, they heard some DJs and then they took some ecstasy. Why was there already a movement in Ibiza before then? Because they're saying they invented the movement, but then who were they listening to in Ibiza and where did they get the ecstasy from? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Was there already a culture of it in Ibiza already? But it's already going.
Yeah, Matt, you've looked into Ibiza in the 60s, but was there any movement there in the 80s just prior to this acid house thing getting started there?
I might be wrong, but from what I can gather, there was like a bohemian beatnik kind of vibe about Ibiza. And there was, yeah, it's kind of like a place. I never went there back then in the 80s to know myself. I'm just going by what I've read. But apparently, according to people who were there at the time, there was kind of this club loungy kind of atmosphere. It was a place where you could go and dance on the beach. It was very it was quite hedonistic, relaxed, chilled out, all at the same time. It was a mixture of all of that. It was just like a paradise place to go and just like let yourself go and just feel the music and meet with, you know, like heads, you know, freaks, bohemians, beatniks, that kind of thing. And certainly in the 1960s, that was very much the case. There weren't nightclubs back then, of course, there weren't DJs as such, but there was music being played. And from what I understand, from what I've looked into in the 1960s, I don't know if you want to go deeply into this now, but in the 1960s, certainly there was a bohemian, beatnik, hippie kind of vibe going on, definitely. And a few of the movers and shakers in the 60s music scene of London, especially, did go over to Ibiza and taste some of that, if you like. We do have evidence of that in some of the music and some movies that came out as well from that time.
Ibiza became kind of the mecca for blooming the whole movement, didn't it, really?
I mean, yeah.
Ibiza, chill out music, I mean, and all that stuff.
With regards to drugs, from what I understand, back in the sort of 50s and 60s, one of the reasons I think that a lot of hippies from the West, so-called West, went to Ibiza was because of the drug trail. There was this drug trail that was going on. I mean, I hear stories now about people who were 18, 20 years old back in the 60s who used to go backpacking across Europe into the Middle East. And a lot of the people that did that, from what I understand, were doing it basically to get drugs to bring back. You've got this trail that there was this drug trail from London to Kathmandu, also Goa, Bangkok, via Morocco and Istanbul and Tehran, Kabul, these kind of destinations. And whilst these people were going, traveling along these routes, picking up, basically going on a drug run, they'd stop off in Ibiza. So they were stopping off in Ibiza to chill out and to taste some of this life that I explained to you, this kind of chilled out, sort of a mix of hedonism and chilled outness. And they were sharing the drugs around. So you could say that, yeah, back in the 60s, there was, from what I've managed to uncover, yeah, from what I understand.
Isn't it a strange irony that all these drugs that we're talking about were all used in MK Ultra experiments?
Yeah, yeah.
MDMA. Every single one of them.
MDMA was, yeah.
Yeah. You almost start to think that it was just a mass MK Ultra.
I'm sure that can't be true, Chris.
Some of the experiments used music, didn't it? Techno frequencies and what have you. With the drug.
Yeah, yeah. I do want to get back to that, but just staying for a moment with this story of these four DJs going out to Ibiza in August 87. With the 60s underground scene, there was obviously spiritual elements to it. There was talk of this incoming Age of Aquarius and the embracing of Eastern mysticism, all this kind of stuff. And there were also spiritual, metaphysical aspects to this story of how the acid house thing got started. So I'm making specific reference here to an interview that was done by The Guardian in 2007 for the 20th anniversary of this acid house scene. And they got Danny Rampling to talk about how that whole thing got started. And Danny's always been a very interesting DJ to listen to, because any other DJ in an interview, they just talk about their career and what they've got going on. But Danny always used to get into higher minded aspects and bring them up himself. So this is a direct quote from him in 2007, where he said, I'll bring something different to the table here. I felt there was something deeper, spiritually, running through the whole experience. I discovered something recently through my own research. In August 1987, there was an event called the Harmonic Convergence, a global shift in unity consciousness to dance rituals, which is part of the Mayan calendar teachings. This is said to have occurred in August of 1987, at the exact time that Paul Oakenfold and his mates went out to Ibiza and apparently had this epiphany and then brought that culture back to the UK. And then, of course, from the UK, it got expanded out to the rest of the world. So it's interesting that we're getting back into spiritual aspects here. And with all these subjects, it seems wherever you have spiritual, metaphysical stuff, military connections are never far away. And where you have military connections, you get MKUltra, you get drugs. Where you get that, unfortunately, you get things like pedophilia and all sorts of really unsavory stuff. And these themes just keep coming up again and again. But it's just interesting the timing on this one. August 87, this harmonic convergence where these planets are supposed to have been conjoined or aligned in a particular way that was having an effect on consciousness. So it's almost as if the social engineers were aware of this and they wanted to steer it off in their own desired directions rather than let it all go its own way naturally. And I think that's quite key.
That's very interesting. It sounds like it was hijacked again, possibly like the previous last 3 years. I do believe that it was some form of a spiritual movement and it was hijacked again. And you could say the same happened in kind of 2012, 2000, you know, bring on this negative or divert this natural thing that's happening to the planet and to people.
Yeah, because in 2020, I reckon there was some kind of download which forced, they didn't want us outside. There was a reason why they didn't want us outside and connecting with other people. Mm. Because to pass the information.
And none of us are astrologists, like proper astrologists. So the thing that Mark's on about there, I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? At the exact same time, they're jumping on the back of the fact that people are becoming more spiritual and they're playing them with drugs, making out that it's a drug movement.
Sorry, just prior to that, with 1986, I've got an excerpt here from an interview with Steve Outrim. He used to do a bunch of shows with Jan Irvin back in the day. I learnt a lot from him. So Steve Outrim said, "One thing I found very useful in my research is that when you look at a timeline for these events, you see that Burning Man, the Burning Man Festival, which is drenched in occult ritual, was launched in 1986. The World Wide Web, the Internet, was launched in 1986. MAPS, the Association for Psychedelic Studies, was launched in 1986. The Cacophony Society, which is closely linked to both Burning Man and Project Mayhem, that was launched in 1986. So you have all these cult-like groups and the internet coming out. And then you have some of the military guys behind the internet saying, what we need is to draw people together in communities electronically. And then the following year, 1987, you get the birth of acid house and electronic dance music.
And in 1986, it was Chicago house, which led on a year later to acid house. Yeah, so you had Chicago house, which was the first kind of house music.
I like that Chicago house.
I loved it. Yeah.
I remember you having all the CDs of Chicago house.
Yeah, well, we're from grandfather were from Chicago.
Mm. Okay.
We didn't know that at the time. That's how mad that is.
Yeah, I remember your collection of Chicago just house probably got me into it, actually.
Yeah, talking of the Burning Man, I read an article, RFK's son, RFK III, the son of this current Robert Kennedy, he's married to an ex-CIA case officer, and they met at the Burning Man Festival.
I was just thinking that. I knew something was rattling around in my head then. Yeah. And also that Burning Man, which is supposed to be...
It's funded by one of the Facebook guys, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's supposed to be this free-flowing hippie thing. I mean, you couldn't get anything...
It burns a wicker man, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's wicker man. It just looks really satanic.
And Steve Outram says that anyone that works in the tech industry in California, Silicon Valley, has to go to Burning Man. It's like a rite of passage. You're just expected to attend Burning Man. Why would that be?
We did a show on Stanford University. And the investment that goes into Stanford University from the venture capitalists or the vulture capitalists, whatever you want to call them, the companies that they've set up are equivalent to something like $3 trillion a year in turnover. And they take a third of all investment in America. So that's how much effort they put in. And also the guys that set up Silicon Valley, the Stanford University professors, I forget the name now, they were eugenicists and they worked for the military. So Stanford University is basically a CIA
a lot
stroke.
Of it.
Yeah, it's like the US equivalent of Tavistock.
Well, a lot of MK Ultra happened at Stanford.
Yeah.
We know that. That's not, that can't be disputed.
Rishi Sunak went to Stanford.
Oh, did he?
Saw that in there, yeah.
Oh, they grew him there. Did they grow him there out of a jar?
Pygmy jar.
Roland's rat, yeah.
Yeah, Roland rat, yeah.
Good Vibrations.
That concludes the first episode in this Good Vibrations analysis of the second Summer of Love of 1988. Come back soon for the remaining three episodes. Thanks again to Dom, Chris and Matt for taking part, and a big thanks to Greg for the editing. See you back here soon.